And the sermon scripture from Genesis chapter 1, verses 1 to 5. In the beginning, when God created the heavens and the earth was a formless void, and darkness covered the face of the deep, while a wind from God swept over the face of the waters. And then God said, "Let there be light," and there was light. And God saw that the light was good, and God separated the light from the darkness. God called the light day, and the darkness he called night. And there was evening, there was morning, in the first day. In 2009, the former beloved pastor of our church, Bill Hirschfeld, presented a three-part sermon series titled, "And God Saw That It Was Good." It just so happens that when he did this, it was the 200th anniversary of the birth of the Englishman, Charles Darwin, who was born on February 12th, 1809. And that's why I wish Rachel were here, but she's sailing without compass over the pond right now. Though this is 8 years later, and I am not Bill Hirschfeld, today happens to be February 12th. And therefore, I think it's appropriate. It's a great day to honor Bill and to remember Charles Darwin. While most of us may recall from your history books that Abraham Lincoln, our greatest president, was also born on February 12, 1809, exactly the same year. I think they were born hours from each other, you know, but they didn't have internet at that time. Few of us on this side of the pond recognize Darwin's origins. With Bill Hirschfeld's background in biology and all things science, he was fully trained as both scientist and as a minister. And he initiated here in 2009 what has become known in many progressive congregations around the country as Evolution Sunday. Though Darwin did not focus on the word evolution until later he wrote in his book Descent of Man and then started including it. The word for him was adaptation, which aligned with his scientific theory involving natural selection and selective breeding. Today the familiar term, though, for us is evolution, and we link that word with his breakout book, Origin of Species. Now, since I was not present for this marvelous sermon series, and since arriving here as your minister in 2015, the memory bank of this congregation includes high praise for Bill's sermon series. Now, Robin Corbin was present for those sermons. Weren't you, Robin? And those three, and I have them now in my little disc bank. In the beginning, and God said, and God saw that it was good, the three sermons. And it therefore seems appropriate for Robin to lead our sermon this morning as a way of both honoring Bill Hirschfeld and celebrating Evolution Sunday here in 2017. So without further ado, do you want to stand here, Robin? And it seems also appropriate that you wear the holy robe.
Oh, dear. Good morning, everybody. Good morning. Today we're celebrating Evolution Sunday. This is sometimes called Darwin Sunday in recognition of Charles Darwin's role as a pioneer in the field. This year's Evolution Sunday happens to actually fall on Darwin's birthday. For us in this church, as John has suggested, it's hard to think of evolution without thinking of Pastor Bill Hirschfeld's three-part series, In the Beginning, and so on. John had heard a lot about those sermons, and I think he was hoping I could somehow channel Bill. He thought maybe the robe would help, but I don't think it's going to. I can't, of course. I don't have Bill's science background. God help me if I ever had to face peer review. Nor do I have his knowledge of theology. But I can, I guess, remind us of how great it is to be in a church where we are not afraid to explore science or theology, each in our own way, as best we can, and not be afraid of stepping on some doctrinal toes or courting an eternity in hell. By the way, I can provide CD copies, like John has, of that series for those who missed out. All right, this is, of course, also our weekly worship service. And we're certainly not here to worship Charles Darwin any more than we might worship Einstein, Newton, or Watson and Crick. Nor are we really here to defend Darwin's work. Evolution in particular and science in general shouldn't need a small-town church to rise to its defense. The work of scientists is subject to peer review, and our opinion shouldn't matter. But a few years back, a group of liberal clergy became very concerned about the efforts of some fundamentalists to discredit evolution and, by extension, science. The latest iteration of this, of course, is the climate change deniers. It's these conservative churches who've had the loudest megaphone in recent years. And it was felt that the voice of a more liberal nature should be heard. Evolution Sunday began as part of what was called the Clergy Letter Project. This was a series of open letters from clergy, and not just Christian clergy. In fact, it's sometimes called Evolution Weekend to reflect that multi-faith background. Anyway, the Clergy Letter Project intended that Evolution Sunday, or Evolution Weekend, would be an annual occasion as, quote, an opportunity for serious discussion and reflection on the relationship between religion and science in an effort to elevate the quality of the discussion on this critical topic and to show that religion and science are not adversaries. End quote. So began an effort to seize the megaphone from the fundamentalists, if for only one day a year. When you think of it, it's odd that poor Darwin gets all the blame for the ways in which science seems to attack Scripture. We don't celebrate heliocentric Sunday or Copernicus Sunday. I guess the notion that the sun is the center of the universe, non-scriptural as it is, has been finally accepted by even the most biblical of churches. So we don't need a Copernicus Sunday. I'm sure someday we won't need an Evolution Sunday either. Why is there a conflict between Christianity and science, between some versions of Christianity and science? Put simply, as long as the inerrancy of scriptures is the starting point of discussion, there can be no discussion. I once saw a bumper sticker that said, God wrote it, I believe it, end of discussion. I think this has to do with fear that if they give an inch, the whole house of cards on which they've built their faith will collapse. And this is an important point. This could, in many cases, also result in a loss of friendships, loss of a supportive social network, and even severed family relationships. It's serious business, and we should be sympathetic to how serious it is. Many denominations grew beyond this house of cards fear years ago, or at least their seminaries did. Biblical scholarship long ago matured to where we understood that what we read in the Bible is a reflection of the concerns of ancient cultures and times. Once we understand the historical and cultural context of what we read in the Bible and the subtle nuances of languages as they evolve over centuries, we can appreciate that these stories, inspired as they may be, are not, to use a fundamentalist term, God-breathed. Bill spoke of and illustrated this analytic method of biblical scholarship in many of his sermons. In more recent times, many liberal churches have felt free to acknowledge that many of the stories in the Bible are myths. Not just myths or only myths. Myths in the sense that, plausible or not, they can be as important to us today as they were ages ago. They are important resources as we try to understand the human condition. Myths are stories that pop up independently in various cultures, hang on for millennia, and are endlessly complex, often involving unconscious processes on both the part of the hearer and the speaker. To dismiss them as a product of ignorant people of the past is to deny ourselves the help they offer us as we struggle with being human. Though biblical literalists don't like to be confronted with contradictions in the Bible, there are many, and they begin right at the get-go in Genesis. There are two accounts of the creation in Genesis, two irreconcilable accounts. This is not an embarrassment to anyone who sees the stories as myths. They aren't literally true, but they do reflect what was percolating in the minds of the people for whom the myths were first important. And they can percolate in the minds of people today. In his three-part series, Bill outlined some of what was percolating in the minds of the people for whom the myths were first important. But Bill also pointed to the third creation story in the Bible, in the book of John. In the beginning was the Word. You could look it up. Here we begin to see how the story of Jesus helps us to understand that God is love, always has been, from the beginning. It just took us a while to evolve to where we could understand that. Of course, since biblical times, we have acquired another tool, in addition to our ancient stories, to help us with our insatiable curiosity. I'm speaking, of course, of science. And it seems to me that science is often trying to close in on some of the same ideas that Genesis was struggling with. But not with any Genesis-inspired preconceptions, letting the chips fall where they may. As I struggled with preparing something for today, I kept turning to Bill's series, listening and listening again. And I kept finding myself tempted to quote his exact words. It was good stuff. But Bill was talking about his reconciling and his celebrating the tension between science and religion. I can't be Bill. You were fortunate if you were here when he delivered his sermons, and not just the creation series, for his whole ministry. Anyway, I decided I was better off sharing a bit of my own reconciling and my own celebration of the balance between science and religion. This I can do with no fear of letting Bill down. So I will close with an example of how I might let science and myth percolate in my mind. The point being that I am free to do so, and so are you. I'm not a theologian, but in my own way, I am as concerned as any theologian about the fundamental questions that humans ask. I'm not a scientist, but I'm free to speculate on the same things scientists do, as long as I don't pretend my meanderings are real science, which, as I say, is peer-reviewed and replicable. We wonder about things. It comes with being human. So maybe God created a being, man. Some of you, I'm going to ask to forgive me using the expression man. Bill reminded us that Adam was actually a gender-neutral word, and so once was man. So maybe God created a being, man, and man was pretty much like the other creatures. And it seems like it wasn't until man became self-aware and curious about things that other animals are not curious about that he became fully human. And it is this new kind of creature, this human being whose post-Eden nature can't help but to respond to these stories, to wonder at them, to let them percolate. And as I say, I'm free to think of these stories in whatever way I want, and so are you. And because they are myth, we are freed of any concern about literal plausibility of the stories. In case I haven't made my point, they are not literally true. Of course they aren't. Period. In the story of eating the apple and the loss of innocence, we are asked to see what makes humans human. The point seems to be that there comes a time when humans have to kick the traces, as Bill put it, to think for themselves and to live with the consequences. After the fall, our newly acquired curiosity won't let us live unselfconsciously, instinctually, like the other animals in the garden. But as Bill pointed out, the Bible also tells us that God looks after us even after we are exiled from the garden. That's largely the theme of the rest of the Bible. To me, it seems pretty obvious that man did not become so distinct from the rest of the animal kingdom because somebody ate an apple and presto changeo. It seems likely that this distinct character evolved over a period of time. There was no sudden change, but there were surely markers along the way. When exactly did we, or our ancestors who were almost we, when did we start making drawings depicting or maybe causing success in the hunt? When did we start burying our dead? Oh, and while we're at it, what are we to make of elephants burying their dead and ceremonially mourning? Are we, after all, so very unique, or is it just that we are a constellation of things that evolved here and there and all came together in humankind? After all, complex social behavior evolved in ants long before it surfaced again in humans, and it's still very rare. I think that science will learn more and more about the evolution of humanness in years to come, and in doing so, they'll have to look at our stories and how they relate to our evolution. They are, after all, quintessentially human, popping up wherever there are humans. I don't want scientists to be timid about following a hunch from a dream or an ancient story, fearing contempt from their peers. And I don't want those on a faith journey to put on blinders so they can't see what's new in science and embrace it. That's, after all, what faith is all about. In today's world, is it really so hard to reconcile what are admittedly timeless truths from the Bible with the ever-advancing, self-correcting search for scientific truth? And is it wise for a society or an individual to be denied the benefits of either approach? After all, both are searching for what will always be an unattainable truth with a capital T. Bill used the metaphor of walking to illustrate what happens when science doesn't mock religion and religion doesn't fear science. John insisted that I revive it today and maybe build on it a bit. There's a metaphor alert. Watch a child learning to walk. At first, the child has to lean on something. Even then, she falls frequently. She just can't get those legs working together, which is sad because the neatest things to explore are often out there where there is nothing to lean on. If the child really wants to explore, to move about freely, she has to overcome her fear of falling. And she has to get her legs to work cooperatively together. Mature walking is nothing more than initiating a fall and smoothly catching yourself as you move into another potential fall and smoothly moving and on and on. Knowing that you can trust your legs, you can move about freely. You can go where you want. You can explore new areas. You need nothing to lean on, and you have no fear of falling. And now I will shamelessly steal from the Reverend Dr. Bill Hirschfeld with the help of my lovely assistant, Margie Annis. This is science. Limping along, following a strictly materialistic view of reality. Proud of its accomplishments, yet knowing it will never stir us as deeply as religion does. Never bring us courage when we are afraid, or comfort for our losses. Sure that there is no such thing as the soul, and somehow feeling ashamed when some annoying idea starts percolating that seems to go beyond strict materialism. This is religion, guardian of eternal truths, handed down in the form of diverse, timeless stories. Respectful of individual experiences that cannot be peer-reviewed or replicated, religion hobbles along fearfully opposing the march of science and insisting that religion's stories be accepted as alternative facts. Knowing that science gives us unmistakable benefits as we learn to care for the one garden we actually have been given, nevertheless denying science a role in helping us to explore the profound mystery in which we live and move and have our being. And this, of course, is religion and science together, needing nothing to lean on, freely moving forward by means of the graceful, perpetual avoidance of falling. So may it be with all of us.